Welcome, everyone, and it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Shauna Stryker, who is our JBD collaborator, but also an assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati at the Family and Community Medicine Department. And Dr. Stryker has graciously agreed to do the interview with the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation as part of our Pride Month. And Dr. Stryker, thank you so much for your time today. And we're honored to have you hosted for this interview. The first thing we'd love to learn more about is, tell us more about your work and what prompted you to join the JBD Collaborator Network.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me here today as well. So my work, I kind of have the trifecta going on. And so I'm an assistant professor, as you said, at the University of Cincinnati. And I work as a physician, as a researcher, and also as a medical educator. And so about half of my time is spent clinically. I work at a local community health center that's in the urban part of Cincinnati, and I serve mostly LGBTQIA plus individuals. My training brought me here because I'm double boarded in family medicine and psychiatry, and I'm also fellowship trained in global health. It was a faculty development fellowship. And so when I'm not seeing patients at the community health center, that's just down the street from our medical center, then I'm doing a mix of teaching. I teach resident physicians. I also teach medical students for the most part, and then a little bit of interprofessional students as well. And then I do research, and much of my research is community engaged. It's participatory, and sometimes I'm using implementation science to figure out how can we better serve individuals who are marginalized, minoritized, and again, because of the clinical work that I do, a lot of that ends up being LGBTQIA plus individuals and also immigrants and refugees. In Cincinnati, there's not the largest overlap between those two groups, but there is some, and it really is my passion to find out ways to better serve this group. We don't need novel new medical interventions all the time. Sometimes we just really need to figure out how the system can better serve these patients. And as far as how I became a GBD collaborator, and so while I was becoming fellowship trained, I did a lot of public health work, and I earned a master's in public health. And during that time, I really got an amazing respect for data. And I think the IHME and the GBD collaborators really does such a fantastic job of displaying what the burden of disease is and what's driving morbidity, what's driving mortality across the globe. And so I found that I was really often going to the GBD website using some of the information about the global burden of disease across the world to understand what the health burdens were in some of the communities that I was working in. I have an ongoing relationship with a primary care group. It's a nonprofit that's in Guatemala that serves the indigenous populations that have some different health burdens than you see in other parts of the country. And so I really found that data was really helpful to me. As someone who's also double boarded in psychiatry and family medicine, I found that across the world, including in urban areas, even in the United States, we really find that there's a mismatch between the need for mental health services and the availability of health services. And I think data really helps show that and really helps prioritize the treatment of global mental health, which sometimes because of stigma is really brushed to the side. And I think there is not a lot of emphasis on it in terms of funding and things like that. I really think the GBD collaborator group can use data to really show where some of these treatment gaps are and where some of this resource allocation really could be better used by health systems. And so I was really excited when I found out I could join as a collaborator and really get a little bit more involved in the way that some of this data is being used and use some of my clinical perspectives to really take advantage of all the data that exists. And it's been really thrilling to get involved in the network and to see the updates as they come in and to see what other groups within the GBD collaboration network are doing so that we can really, again, understand better how to move the needle on health equity in different parts of the world.
Thank you. My next question is, we are in the midst of Pride Month, commemorated around the globe for the significant progress and strides realized by the LGBTQIA+ community and its allies in terms of advancing queer rights and contributions to improving the lives, freedom, and safety of the queer individuals. Pride Month also serves as a stark reminder that progress on LGBTQIA+ rights is still very much lagging in many parts of the world, and that more work is needed. What does Pride mean for you personally?
Yeah, so for me personally, and again, speaking as an individual and not as a representative of any health system or government, I can say that personally for me, Pride is a mixed bag, as you alluded to. And so Pride really started in protest. And yes, there's celebration. And some of the things that I think the general population thinks of with Pride is these parades that we have. This weekend, actually, just the day after we're filming this actually is when my city is going to host their large Pride parade. And it's a great event. And so I would love it if Pride really meant that we could just celebrate joy, that we could celebrate people being able to live authentically and bring their full selves forward. I think that having positivity about love and about sex and about the ways that queer people can really thrive is beautiful and it's great. I think someone being able to just express themselves the way that they want to and have people clap for them rather than yell at them is something that really is beautiful. But I also recognize during this month, I think especially this year, it feels like there's a lot of time for reflection on the way that Pride started, which is by protest. And so across the world, there really is still, as you said, so much work to be done. And so really there are so many parts of the world in which people can't at all be themselves. They can't even speak about the people that they love. They can't talk about their chosen families without being at risk of danger. And they're not able to speak even to their healthcare providers about who they love, about their support network. And I think across the globe, and this includes in my own country of the United States, we're seeing a wave of legislation that is really worrisome to me as a healthcare provider and can really impact the health of my patients. I think that there is a lot of suppression of queerness, despite the fact that we see evidence of queer people throughout different cultures and across time. You know, there's evidence that this has been a normal part of human society. And yet these days, it seems like very much there's a movement towards making queer individuals invisible. And that's really concerning to me. And so I've spent probably more time this month actually in advocacy and in protest as an individual of some of the things that I see in terms of the direction that I think we're moving in across the globe. And so really June for me is a blend. There's a little bit of celebration of queer joy and of people being to be able to authentically be them full selves. But there's also constant reminders of all the work that we have to do and all of the pain, frankly, that I hear about on a daily basis from folks that are in the LGBTQIA plus community. I also work with a lawyer, and so I work with a nonprofit legal group in town. And in my role as a physician, I do forensic medical and psychological evaluations of individuals who are seeking asylum. And so as much as I am worried at some of the legislation that I have seen, even again in the United States here, it's also just a really humbling reminder that some people are still coming to the United States seeking asylum because they are queer and because it is even more dangerous for them to be out and to be queer in the places that they're coming from. And there are many parts of the world in which it's criminalized, again, to love. And so I hear stories of individuals who are here seeking asylum. And again, my role is to do a psychological evaluation of their mental health. Many of them are survivors of trauma or survivors of torture because of the environment that they're coming from. And even though I'm worried about the political environment that I see, even in my own country, I recognize that in other parts of the world, it is even worse. And again, that's humbling and just a constant reminder of the work that we have to do and the threat to wellness and to safety that many LGBTQIA people across the globe have to deal with on a daily basis.
What are the most important lessons you've learned from your work with the LGBTQIA plus patients and the area of LGBTQIA plus health in general?
I think one thing that's really remarkable and that you find in other aspects of medicine, but I think you cannot help but ignore when you care for LGBTQIA plus individuals, is that social and societal and structural determinants of health really have a dramatic impact on the health of the individuals that I serve, especially the LGBTQIA plus migrants that I serve. They don't have the luxury of not paying attention to politics. Politics directly affects their health. It directly affects their well-being. And so it's really obvious, I think, when you work with a group of individuals like this, that the social determinants of health and that politics and that society can really directly impact not only their mental health, which I think it's pretty, many people can conceptualize how mental health can be driven by living in a society in which you feel like you have to hide a part of yourself, but also physical health. We know that social threats, and we know that being isolated and being rejected and even just anticipating discrimination, that directly is going to affect even your physical health. The work of Lisa Diamond shows that inflammation is one of the drivers of that phenomenon that we see, but it is really dramatic, the physical and mental health burden that the patients that I serve have to deal with and the amount of hypervigilance that they have. Again, many of them are survivors of some sort of trauma, and they have to always be aware of their safety. And that really can place a burden on the health of individuals. That having your stress hormones constantly in overdrive is going to directly affect the health of individuals, and especially non-communicable diseases. I see much higher rates than I should, given the other risk factors that some of my patients have. And all of that is compounded by other marginalized, minoritized identities. And so some of the individuals that I have that are also racial and ethnic minorities, for instance, and are trans and are feminine, those are the individuals in which I really see much higher rates of chronic disease, despite an amazing amount of resilience.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker. What are some of the biggest challenges or obstacles you would say you have faced in your scientific research on the LGBTQIA plus community?
So I think one of the biggest barriers to doing more research in this world, first of all, is just that we actually don't have great data. I think it's not uniformly and universally common practice to collect what we call SOGI data, and that's sexual orientation and gender identity data. And so in some of the big data sets that we're using to understand trends of disease across the world, they're really just that data is not there. And what that does is it makes queer individuals invisible. It makes it so that we cannot have the data to fully understand some of the health conditions that they are afflicted with, some of the suffering that they're living through. And so without having that data collected, it can be really hard to understand disease trends. I think that there are ways that you can do this well, but I do think that in general, that is missing from a lot of data sets, especially if we're looking globally. And I think that there's good reason for that in some places. As I said, there are parts of the world in which being an LGBTQIA plus individual is criminalized. It is life-threatening for that to be discovered about you. And so therefore, it would not be safe in a place like that to routinely collect that information. There are times in which understanding the sexual orientation and gender identity of individuals beyond binary sex is going to be really critical for understanding the burden of disease in the country. And so when it is safe to do so, I think that that can really make research even better. The other thing is, again, this population that I serve, they have had a lot of trauma, including medical trauma. Medical spaces have often not been safe for individuals who are queer. And research is the same thing. Some of them have not felt safe in research spaces. And so I think that that is another barrier that we find to doing some scientific research is, understandably, people have, again, either a history of discrimination personally or because of what has happened historically within the community, there is anticipated discrimination. And that is going to mean so that even if there is a concerted effort of researchers to include queer individuals within their participants, there can, again, understandably be some hesitation from the community because of mistreatment in the past.
Dr. Stryker, what would be your advice to early career professionals in public health working towards highlighting the inequities and disparities in access to healthcare for LGBTQIA+ individuals?
So I really think, because I had previously said that the lack of data collection is a real barrier to fully understanding LGBTQIA+ health, I really think that making sure that people are collecting that data when it is relevant and when it's safe to do so is one of the best things that people can do if they want to understand more about LGBTQIA+ health. I think, as I said, we see vast differences. We see disparities in physical health. We see disparities in mental health. We even see higher mortality in LGBTQIA+ individuals. And so I think that really, if you have an interest in any disease, it's important to understand whether there's disparities within that community. And we only know if we're asking that question and ensuring safety of people to be able to answer that question well. The other thing I would recommend is working with community members if you're not a part of the community yourself. And even if you are, the community is so diverse, it's so broad, that there are many queer individuals who might be professionals and even researchers themselves, but they don't understand the experiences of individuals who are a different part of the community. And so, for instance, I think transgender and gender diverse individuals in particular get understudied. You know, we use this acronym LGBTQIA+ individuals as an effort to include the broader community, but many times in even well-intentioned research within this field, the T is underemphasized. And the experiences of gender minorities is vastly different than sexual minorities. And in some ways, particularly, again, if we have other minoritized identities, it can be much worse. And so I think making sure that you're including the full community and partnering, importantly, with the community, even if you're a part of the community yourself, making sure you're partnering with individuals that are part of a different subset of the community, that can be really important for driving your research and for focusing your research, because there's so much work to be done. I think that letting them guide you about what's most important to them can be incredibly helpful for researchers that are just starting out along this path. The other thing that I think can be really helpful beyond partnering with community members and beyond making sure that you're collecting data is remembering that documenting the disparities is not enough. I think that there's plenty of data now in countries in which it's safe to do so, in which we have at least a good glimpse of where some of those disparities, and particularly for sexual minorities, lie. However, in places in which that data has already been described, I don't think it's helpful to continue doing that research. And I think really we need to start understanding more about the mechanisms through which individuals are having these social and structural determinants of health affect their physical health and affect their mental health. And so really understanding those mechanisms is going to better allow us to intervene. Again, I said I use implementation science in my work sometimes. We often have evidence-based strategies for improving different health outcomes. They're just not being applied and not being applied across different settings. And so using approaches like implementation science to help guide evidence-based interventions, making sure that you're focusing on mechanisms of health disparities, and making sure that you're also focusing on interventions when there is room for novel interventions to be developed to combat some of the disparities that we're seeing. I think that is critically needed as well when, again, the data has already documented the disparities that are there.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker. A question related to this: where do you see the biggest need to invest resources? And specifically, how do you choose to invest your time in educating other public health professionals about the disparities that the LGBTQIA+ communities are faced with?
I think the disparities are great enough that one of the biggest factors that could make a big difference is actually just increasing access to healthcare, and not just any healthcare, but culturally humble healthcare and meeting with health providers that are trained, that are open, that are ready to support LGBTQIA+ individuals. We know that in general, a lot of healthcare providers do not get adequate health education on how to serve this community. If it's a part of their curriculum, it's very pretty minor. And so one thing that I think we could do is, again, rather than spending all of this time trying to find new novel interventions, is actually just really better preparing the clinical workforce to better serve this population. That way, we will see less people having bad experiences when they do seek healthcare services. Right now, that is what happens to most individuals. Even when they go and seek healthcare, they are discriminated against within a healthcare setting. That is going to lead to avoidance of care. That is going to lead to delay of care. And evidence shows that this happens. When people, especially with chronic disease, present later in the course of their illness, their outcomes are going to be worse. And so if we can create a workforce that's better prepared to serve these individuals, people are going to have less bad experiences. There's going to be less discrimination and less anticipated discrimination that really drives the delay and the avoidance of needed medical care, so that for especially these non-communicable diseases, we can see people presenting earlier and have better outcomes. So that's really actually where I focus a lot of my work is, again, I focus on medical education, actually. How do we better educate interprofessional clinicians and researchers to serve and study this population better, so that I don't see so many people that have a history of medical trauma and medical mistrust. I really think that ultimately is a great first step. And then once there is a healthcare system that is prepared to care for, to receive these individuals, then we can start working on the things that are going to actually improve those health outcomes. But we already have studies that show that when people have a clinician that they can trust, and I'm biased because I work in primary care, so I really think in many parts of the world, including, again, high resource settings, that is the entry point of individuals into the healthcare system. And so particularly if we can better prepare primary care to serve this population, I think we're going to see better health outcomes. That alone will help drive down some of these disparities. And that, again, in some research has already been shown to have positive health benefits of if someone has a healthcare provider that they feel like they can trust, that they can be fully honest with, that they can really be their authentic selves without having to hide important parts of themselves from their healthcare provider. Having that trusting relationship makes a big difference. And so I think that is an important area in which more work needs to be done while we're doing some of these other studies that I previously mentioned about mechanism of disease and about interventions and things like that. So that is where I think a good place to start would be.
Dr. Stryker, in your opinion, what are some of the advancements in health data collection that should be made to help public health professionals and researchers study the disparities in health for the LGBTQIA+ community?
So I want to start off by saying that there are settings in which it would be dangerous to collect this data. And so I think that should be the first question that every researcher asks themselves is it safe for me to collect this data? Is this data going to be able to be tied to individuals that could then be criminalized and could be harmed because they have revealed something about themselves that is stigmatized in the place that I'm in? If that criteria is met, then I think it's worth moving forward if it is actually going to be helpful. And again, I think that's the other thing is we do want people to, we want to collect this data only if we're actually going to use it and only if it's actually helpful. There are some guidelines. So the National Institutes of Health of the U.S. Has developed in 2022. There was a report that was released after a work group was formed on some of the best practices for collecting this data. And so I think that report can be really helpful for public health professionals in thinking about if they're collecting data, if they're designing surveys, what those questions can look like. I'll just highlight one thing that I think is really important that's not always routinely done is I think a two-step approach to asking about gender identity can be really helpful. And so it's really helpful to ask what people's sex designated at birth was. And also making sure that you're not forgetting about intersex individuals when you ask that question. And then the next step would be asking about gender identity. Sex and gender are different concepts. They, for many people, are related, and they are, for many people, very important, but they're different concepts. Sex is a biological variable, whereas gender identity is more of a social variable. And that can be something that changes over time and can be incredibly important to understand about their about an individual, to understand their experiences in life. And so asking sex designated at birth, but then also asking what the gender identity is, can be really helpful. The other thing that I see some researchers do, and again, they're well-intentioned, is when they're asking about either sexual orientation or they're asking about gender identity, there are binary options and then other. And I think using the word other can be really stigmatizing for individuals. And so making sure that you're saying, I would like to use another response, and making sure that there's an ability for people to write in their answer. You can't, of course, come up with every option that people are going to use as identifiers. However, making sure that you're not othering individuals by including other as an option can be incredibly important. And also making sure that you're acknowledging that for some individuals, it may not be a choose one of these answers that is actually going to work best for them. And so when you are going to be able to analyze your data accordingly, making sure that you allow for individuals to choose multiple answers, particularly for gender identity, can be really important.
Dr. Stryker, what role do you think health research institutes like IHME could play in advancing the field of LGBTQIA+ health on a global level?
So I really think data can make such a huge impact. And that is why I don't see patients 100% of the time. I do a blend, because I think data can make a difference on a structural level. And I think that that's incredibly important. So I think places like IHME, if they are making sure that they are collecting the data that is available on sexual orientation and gender identity to help tell the story about what the experiences of populations is, then that can really add to individual storytelling to make sure that we can understand the impacts of, again, policy on health. I think that it is only large data sets that can really help tell that story in a larger level. And I think that if you can have the data show the disparities, and then especially show the impact that policy can have, because much of the data that places like IHME have is longitudinal. And so showing the impact of policy directly on health can really help advocate with policymakers about how policy can be used to promote health in a way that is more affirming and more positive and more driven towards health and wellness. And I really think it's going to take groups that have access to a large set of data in order to help tell those stories, in order to help move the needle on showing how we can do better. Because I also think there are places that are doing better, and highlighting some of those experiences can set an example for other places that have a lot of work to do, which is much of the world, unfortunately.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker. Tell us what motivates or inspires you in your day-to-day work. As they say, what would be one key thing that gets you out of bed every day to work in the field you have chosen professionally? And related to this, how would you like for your work to be remembered?
I think that there is just nothing like queer joy and trans joy. And so seeing somebody who has been having to hide a part of themselves for most or all of their lives be able to be them full selves and share that with you is one of the most amazing things in the world. Especially for some of the trans folks that I serve, some of them really are going to have their lives improved through transition-related medical services. Not all of them want that, not all of them need that, but for the folks for whom they've really decided that that is going to be a necessary part of their story, being able to provide that for people and seeing people blossom in that way just makes all of it worth it. Again, I wish that that could be more of the expectation than the exception, because right now access to care can be so difficult for queer individuals and trans individuals, and we know that it's a cost of hiding your true self. That you take it, that takes a toll on your health, on your emotional health, and on your physical health. And seeing someone really be able to blossom and be their true selves and look at themselves in the mirror for people who couldn't have done that before, it is just like the biggest privilege in the world to be able to help people really find that within themselves and really be able to engage that resilience that they had in them and really be able to express and show the world their joy. That is what keeps me doing this difficult work. And can you remind me what the second part of the question was?
How would you like for your work to be remembered?
So I would love if my work were remembered by me being seen as an example for how physicians in particular can really be an accomplice in trans liberation. Because again, that's what drives me. And that is what keeps me doing this work and keeps me advocating for my patients. I really think that if my work were shown as an example that was reproducible in other settings for how to really, again, be an accomplice, not just an ally, but an accomplice to trans liberation, that would be it. That would have made all of the years of training worth it beyond the privilege that I already get from doing the clinical care that I do.
If you had a magic wand and could change three things in the world, what would that be?
So I'm going to be really ambitious with my answer here. So the first I think would be gender equity. And by that, I mean equity across all genders. We've, again, seen that that can just make such a difference in the health of the world. And so gender equity would be number one for me. Number two would be racial equity across skin tones. I see that racial inequities, again, have such a direct impact on the health of the individuals I serve. And racial inequities causes so many health problems within our society. So number two would be racial equity. And then number three would actually be improved mental health literacy for all. I think that across many societies, we don't learn a lot about mental health. We don't learn about our emotions and expressing our emotions and understanding our emotions and how to deal with negative emotions. I think there's a little bit too much emphasis on purely just using distraction as a way to cope with negative emotions. And I really think that in this world, if we had better gender equity, better racial equity, and improved mental health literacy, that would make the world a healthier place.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker. We have come to the end of our interview, so I do want to thank you again on behalf of all of our team at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation for sharing your time with us and your expertise in the area of LGBTQIA+ health, crucially important, as you have highlighted earlier. And really, thank you for setting the example to other public health professionals out there on how we can better work to dismantle some of these disparities and inequities we're seeing across the country and also outside the U.S. And I want to commend you for doing the work that really helps improve the lives of many queer individuals across the U.S.
Well, and thank you. It's truly a privilege to do the work that I do and also to meet with you and to work with IHME.
Thank you.